An Unpleasant Predicament, written by Fyodor Dostoevsky. This unpleasant business occurred at the epoch when the regeneration of our beloved fatherland and the struggle of her valiant sons towards new hopes and destinies was beginning with irresistible force and with a touchingly naive impetuosity. One winter evening in that period, between 11 and 12 o'clock, three highly respectable gentlemen were sitting in a comfortable and even luxuriously furnished room in a handsome house of two stories on the Petersburg side, and were engaged in a staid and edifying conversation on a very interesting subject. These three gentlemen were all of general's rank. They were sitting round a little table, each in a soft and handsome armchair, and as they talked, they quietly and luxuriously sipped champagne. The bottle stood on the table on a silver stand with ice round it. The fact was that the host, a privy councillor called Stepan Nikiforovich Nikiforov, an old bachelor of 65, was celebrating his removal into a house he had just bought, and, as it happened, also his birthday, which he had never kept before. The festivity, however, was not on a very grand scale. As we have seen already, there were only two guests, both of them former colleagues and former subordinates of Mr. Nikiforov. That is, an actual civil councillor called Semyon Ivanovich Shipolyenko, and another actual civil councillor, Ivan Ilyich Prolinsky. They had arrived to tea at 9 o'clock, then had begun upon the wine, and knew that at exactly 11:30 they would have to set off home. Their host had all his life been fond of regularity. A few words about him. He had begun his career as a petty clerk with nothing to back him, had quietly plodded on for 45 years, knew very well what to work towards, had no ambition to draw the stars down from heaven, though he had 2 stars already, and particularly disliked expressing his own opinion on any subject. He was honest, too. That is, it had not happened to him to do anything particularly dishonest. He was a bachelor because he was an egoist. He had plenty of brains, but he could not bear showing his intelligence. He particularly disliked slovenliness and enthusiasm, regarding it as moral slovenliness, and towards the end of his life had become completely absorbed in a voluptuous, indolent comfort and systematic solitude. Though he sometimes visited people of a rather higher rank than his own, yet from his youth up he could never endure entertaining visitors himself, and of late he had, if he did not play a game of patience, been satisfied with the society of his dining-room clock, and would spend the whole evening dozing in his armchair, listening placidly to its ticking under its glass case on the chimney-piece. In appearance, he was closely shaven and extremely proper-looking. He was well-preserved, looking younger than his age. He promised to go on living many years longer, and closely followed the rules of the highest good breeding. His post was a fairly comfortable one. He had to preside somewhere and to sign something. In short, he was regarded as a first-rate man. He had only one passion, or more accurately, one keen desire. That was to have his own house, and a house built like a gentleman's residence, not a commercial investment. His desire was at last realized. He looked out and bought a house on the Petersburg side, a good way off, it is true, but it had a garden and was an elegant house. The new owner decided that it was better for being a good way off. He did not like entertaining at home, and for driving to see anyone or to the office he had a handsome carriage of a chocolate hue, a coachman, Michi, and 2 little but strong and handsome horses. All this was honourably acquired by the careful frugality of 40 years, so that his heart rejoiced over it. This was how it was that Stepan Nikiforovich felt such pleasure in his placid heart that he actually invited 2 friends to see him on his birthday, which he had hitherto carefully concealed from his most intimate acquaintances. He had special designs on one of these visitors. He lived in the upper story of his new house, and he wanted a tenant for the lower half, which was built and arranged in exactly the same way. Stepan Nikiforovitch was reckoning upon Semyon Ivanovitch Shipulyenko, and had twice that evening broached the subject in the course of conversation. But Semyon Ivanovitch made no response. The latter, too, was a man who had doggedly made a way for himself in the course of long years. He had black hair and whiskers, and a face that always had a shade of jaundice. He was a married man of morose disposition, who liked to stay at home. He ruled his household with a rod of iron. In his official duties he had the greatest self-confidence. He, too, knew perfectly well what goal he was making for, and, better still, what he never would reach. He was in a good position, and he was sitting tight there. Though he looked upon the new reforms with a certain distaste, he was not particularly agitated about them. He was extremely self-confident, and listened with a shade of ironical malice to Ivan Ilyich Pralinsky expatiating on new themes. All of them had been drinking rather freely, however, so that Stepan Nikiforovitch himself condescended to take part in a slight discussion with Mr. Pralinsky concerning the latest reforms. But we must say a few words about His Excellency Mr. Pralinsky, especially as he is the chief hero of the present story. The actual civil councillor, Ivan Ilyich Pralinsky, had only been His Excellency for 4 months. In short, he was a young general. He was young in years, too, only 43, no more, and he looked and liked to look even younger. He was a tall, handsome man. He was smart in his dress, and prided himself on its solid, dignified character. With great aplomb, he displayed an order of some consequence on his breast. From his earliest childhood he had known how to acquire the airs and graces of aristocratic society, and, being a bachelor, dreamed of a wealthy and even aristocratic bride. He dreamed of many other things, though he was far from being stupid. At times he was a great talker, and even liked to assume a parliamentary pose. He came of a good family. He was the son of a general, and brought up in the lap of luxury. In his tender childhood he had been dressed in velvet and fine linen, had been educated at an aristocratic school, and, though he acquired very little learning there, he was successful in the service, and had worked his way up to being a general. The authorities looked upon him as a capable man, and even expected great things from him in the future. Stepan Nikiforovitch, under whom Ivan Ilyich had begun his career in the service, and under whom he had remained until he was made a general, had never considered him a good businessman, and had no expectations of him whatever. What he liked in him was that he belonged to a good family, had property, that is, a big block of buildings let out in flats, in charge of an overseer, was connected with persons of consequence, and, what was more, had a majestic bearing. Stepan Nikiforovitch blamed him inwardly for excess of imagination and instability. Ivan Ilyich himself felt at times that he had too much amour-propre, and even sensitiveness. Strange to say, he had attacks from time to time of morbid tenderness of conscience, and even a kind of faint remorse. With bitterness and a secret soreness of heart, he recognized now and again that he did not fly so high as he imagined. At such moments he sank into despondency, especially when he was suffering from hemorrhoids, called his life une existence manquée, and ceased, privately of course, to believe even in his parliamentary capacities, calling himself a talker, a maker of phrases, and though all that of course did him great credit, it did not in the least prevent him from raising his head again half an hour later, and growing even more obstinately, even more conceitedly self-confident, and assuring himself that he would yet succeed in making his mark, and that he would be not only a great official, but a statesman whom Russia would long remember. He actually dreamed at times of monuments. From this it will be seen that Ivan Ilyich aimed high, though he hid his vague hopes and dreams deep in his heart, even with a certain trepidation. In short, he was a good-natured man and a poet at heart. Of late years, these morbid moments of disillusionment had begun to be more frequent. He had become peculiarly irritable, ready to take offence, and was apt to take any contradiction as an affront. But reformed Russia gave him great hopes. His promotion to general was the finishing touch. He was roused. He held his head up. He suddenly began talking freely and eloquently. He talked about the new ideas, which he very quickly and unexpectedly made his own, and professed with vehemence. He sought opportunities for speaking, drove about the town, and in many places succeeded in gaining the reputation of a desperate liberal, which flattered him greatly. That evening, after drinking 4 glasses, he was particularly exuberant. He wanted on every point to confute Stepan Nikiforovitch, whom he had not seen for some time past, and whom he had hitherto always respected and even obeyed. He considered him for some reason reactionary, and fell upon him with exceptional heat. Stepan Nikiforovitch hardly answered him, but only listened slyly, though the subject interested him. Ivan Ilyich got hot, and, in the heat of the discussion, sipped his glass more often than he ought to have done. Then Stepan Nikiforovitch took the bottle and at once filled his glass again, which for some reason seemed to offend Ivan Ilyich, especially as Semyon Ivanovich Shipolyenko, whom he particularly despised and indeed feared on account of his cynicism and ill nature, preserved a treacherous silence and smiled more frequently than was necessary. "They seem to take me for a schoolboy," flashed across Ivan Ilyich's mind. "No, it was time, high time," he went on hotly. "We have put it off too long, and to my thinking, humanity is the first consideration. Humanity with our inferiors, remembering that they too are men. Humanity will save everything, and bring out all that is..." was heard from the direction of Semyon Ivanovitch. "But why are you giving us such a talking to?" Stepan Nikiforovitch protested at last with an affable smile. "I must own, Ivan Ilyich, I have not been able to make out so far what you are maintaining. You advocate humanity, that is, love of your fellow creatures, isn't it?" "Yes, if you like, allow me. As far as I can see, that's not the only thing. Love of one's fellow creatures has always been fitting. The reform movement is not confined to that. All sorts of questions have arisen relating to the peasantry, the law courts, economics, government contracts, morals, and those questions are endless, and altogether may give rise to great upheavals, so to say. That is what we have been anxious about, and not simply humanity." "Yes, the thing is a bit deeper than that," observed Semyon Ivanovitch. "I quite understand, and allow me to observe, Semyon Ivanovitch, that I can't agree to being inferior to you in depth of understanding," Ivan Ilyich observed sarcastically and with excessive sharpness. "However, I will make so bold as to assert, Stepan Nikiforovitch, that you have not understood me either." "No, I haven't. And yet I maintain and everywhere advance the idea that humanity and nothing else with one's subordinates, from the official in one's department down to the copying clerk, from the copying clerk down to the house serf, from the servant down to the peasant, humanity, I say, may serve, so to speak, as the cornerstone of the coming reforms and the reformation of things in general. Why? Because, take a syllogism. I am human, consequently I am loved. I am loved, so confidence is felt in me. There is a feeling of confidence, and so there is trust. There is trust, and so there is love. That is, No, I mean to say that if they trust me, they will believe in the reforms. They will understand, so to speak, the essential nature of them, will, so to speak, embrace each other in a moral sense, and will settle the whole business in a friendly way, fundamentally. What are you laughing at, Semyon Ivanovitch? Can't you understand? Stepan Nikiforovitch raised his eyebrows without speaking. He was surprised. I fancy I have drunk a little too much, said Semyon Ivanovitch sarcastically, and so I'm a little slow of comprehension, not quite all my wits about me. Ivan Ilyich winced. We should break down, Stepan Nikiforovitch pronounced suddenly, after a slight pause of hesitation. How do you mean we should break down? Asked Ivan Ilyich, surprised at Stepan Nikiforovitch's abrupt remark. Why, we should break under the strain, Stepan Nikiforovitch evidently did not care to explain further. I suppose you are thinking of new wine in old bottles, Ivan Ilyich replied, not without irony. Well, I can answer for myself anyway. At that moment, the clock struck 11:30. One sits on, but one must go at last, said Semyon Ivanovitch, getting up. But Ivan Ilyich was before him. He got up from the table and took his sable cap from the chimney-piece. He looked as though he had been insulted. "So how is it to be, Semyon Ivanovitch? Will you think it over?" said Stepan Nikiforovitch, as he saw the visitors out. "About the flat, you mean? I'll think it over, I'll think it over." "Well, when you have made up your mind, let me know as soon as possible." "Still on business," Mr. Prolinsky observed affably, in a slightly ingratiating tone, playing with his hat. It seemed to him as though they were forgetting him. Stepan Nikiforovitch raised his eyebrows and remained mute, as a sign that he would not detain his visitors. Semyon Ivanovitch made haste to bow himself out. "Well, after that, what is one to expect, if you don't understand the simple rules of good manners?" Mr. Prolinsky reflected to himself, and held out his hand to Stepan Nikiforovitch in a particularly off-hand way. In the hall, Ivan Ilyich wrapped himself up in his light, expensive fur coat. He tried for some reason not to notice Semyon Ivanovitch's shabby raccoon, and they both began descending the stairs. "The old man seems offended," said Ivan Ilyich to the silent Semyon Ivanovitch. "No? Why?" answered the latter with cool composure. "Servile flunky," Ivan Ilyich thought to himself. They went out at the front door. Semyon Ivanovitch's sledge with a grey, ugly horse drove up. "What the devil? What has Trifon done with my carriage?" cried Ivan Ilyich, not seeing his carriage. The carriage was nowhere to be seen. Stepan Nikiforovitch's servant knew nothing about it. They appealed to Varlam, Semyon Ivanovitch's coachman, and received the answer that he had been standing there all the time, and that the carriage had been there, but now there was no sign of it. "An unpleasant predicament," Mr. Shipulyenka pronounced. "Shall I take you home?" "Scoundrelly people!" Mr. Prolinsky cried with fury. "He asked me, the rascal, to let him go to a wedding close here in the Petersburg side. Some crony of his was getting married, deuce take her. I sternly forbade him to absent himself, and now I'll bet he has gone off there."
"He has certainly gone off there," observed Varlam, "but he promised to be back in a minute, to be here in time, that is."
"Well, there it is. I had a presentiment that this would happen. I'll give it to him."
"You'd better give him a good flogging once or twice at the police station. Then he will do what you tell him," said Semyon Ivanovitch, as he wrapped the rug round him.
"Please don't trouble yourself, Semyon Ivanovitch." "Well, won't you let me take you along?"
"Merci, bon voyage."
Semyon Ivanovitch drove off, while Ivan Ilyich set off on foot along the wooden pavement, conscious of a rather acute irritation.
"Yes, indeed, I'll give it to you now, you rogue. I am going on foot on purpose to make you feel it, to frighten you. He will come back and hear that his master has gone off on foot, the blackguard."
Ivan Ilyich had never abused anyone like this, but he was greatly angered, and besides, there was a buzzing in his head. He was not given to drink, so 5 or 6 glasses soon affected him. But the night was enchanting. There was a frost, but it was remarkably still, and there was no wind. There was a clear, starry sky. The full moon was bathing the earth in soft, silver light. It was so lovely that after walking some 50 paces, Ivan Ilyich almost forgot his troubles. He felt particularly pleased. People quickly change from one mood to another when they are a little drunk. He was even pleased with the ugly little wooden houses of the deserted street. "It's really a capital thing that I am walking," he thought. "It's a lesson to Trifon and a pleasure to me. I really ought to walk oftener. And I shall soon pick up a sledge on the great prospect. It's a glorious night. What little houses they all are. I suppose small fry live here. Clerks, tradesmen, perhaps. That's Stepan Nikiforovitch. What reactionaries they all are, those old fogies. Fogies, yes, c'est le mot. He is a sensible man, though. He has that bon sens, sober, practical understanding of things. But they are old, old. There is a lack of... what is it? There is a lack of something. We shall break down. What did he mean by that? He actually pondered when he said it. He didn't understand me a bit. And yet how could he help understanding? It was more difficult not to understand it than to understand it. The chief thing is that I am convinced, convinced in my soul. Humanity, the love of one's kind. Restore a man to himself, revive his personal dignity, and then, when the ground is prepared, get to work. I believe that's clear. Yes. Allow me, Your Excellency. Take a syllogism, for instance. We meet, for instance, a clerk, a poor, downtrodden clerk. Well, who are you? Answer, a clerk. Very good, a clerk. Further, what sort of clerk are you? Answer, I am such and such a clerk, he says. Are you in the service? I am. Do you want to be happy? I do. What do you need for happiness? This and that. Why? Because, and there the man understands me with a couple of words, the man's mine, the man is caught, so to speak, in a net, and I can do what I like with him. That is, for his good. Horrid man, that Semyon Ivanovitch, and what a nasty fizz he has. Flog him in the police station. He said that on purpose. No, you are talking rubbish. You can flog, but I'm not going to. I shall punish Trifon with words. I shall punish him with reproaches. He will feel it. As for flogging, it is an open question. What about going to Emerence? Oh, damnation take it, the cursed pavement, he cried out, suddenly tripping up. And this is the capital, enlightenment. One might break one's leg. I detest that Semyon Ivanovitch. A most revolting fizz. He was chuckling at me just now when I said they would embrace each other in a moral sense. Well, and they will embrace each other. And what's that to do with you? I'm not going to embrace you. I'd rather embrace a peasant. If I meet a peasant, I shall talk to him. I was drunk, though, and perhaps did not express myself properly. Possibly I am not expressing myself rightly now. I shall never touch wine again. In the evening you babble, and next morning you are sorry for it. After all, I am walking quite steadily, but they are scoundrels anyhow. So Ivan Ilyich meditated incoherently and by snatches as he went on striding along the pavement. The fresh air began to affect him, set his mind working. 5 minutes later,
he would have felt soothed and sleepy. But all at once, scarcely 2 paces from the great prospect, he heard music. He looked round. On the other side of the street, in a very tumble-down-looking long wooden house of 1 story, there was a great fete. There was the scraping of violins, and the droning of a double bass, and the squeaky tooting of a flute playing a very gay quadrille tune. Under the windows stood an audience, mainly of women in wadded pelisses, with kerchiefs on their head. They were straining every effort to see something through a crack in the shutters. Evidently there was a gay party within. The sound of the thud of dancing feet reached the other side of the street. Ivan Ilyich saw a policeman standing not far off, and went up to him. "Whose house is that, brother?" he asked, flinging his expensive fur coat open, just far enough to allow the policeman to see the imposing decoration on his breast.
"It belongs to the registration clerk, Sildonimov," answered the policeman, drawing himself up instantly, discerning the decoration.
"Sildonimov? Ha! Sildonimov! What is he up to? Getting married?"
"Yes, Your Honour. To a tutor of a titular councillor. Mlekopitaev. A titular councillor. Used to serve in the municipal department. That house goes with the bride."
"So that house is now Sildonimov's, and not Mlekopitaev's?"
"Yes, Sildonimov's, Your Honour. It was Mlekopitaev's, but now it is Sildonimov's."
"Hmm. I am asking you, my man, because I am his chief. I am a general in the same office in which Sildonimov serves."
"Just so, Your Excellency."
The policeman drew himself up more stiffly than ever, while Ivan Ilyich seemed to ponder. He stood still and meditated. Yes, Sildonimov really was in his department, and in his own office. He remembered that. He was a little clerk with a salary of 10 rubles a month. As Mr. Prolinsky had received his department very lately, he might not have remembered precisely all his subordinates, but Sildonimov he remembered just because of his surname. It had caught his eye from the very first, so that, at the time, he had had the curiosity to look with special attention at the possessor of such a surname. He remembered now a very young man with a long, hooked nose, with tufts of flaxen hair, lean and ill-nourished, and an impossible uniform, and with unmentionables so impossible as to be actually unseemly. He remembered how the thought had flashed through his mind at the time. Shouldn't he give the poor fellows 10 rubles for Christmas to spend on his wardrobe? But as the poor fellow's face was too austere, and his expression extremely unprepossessing, even exciting repulsion, the good-natured idea somehow faded away of itself, so Sildonimov did not get his tip. He had been the more surprised when this same Sildonimov had, not more than a week before, asked for leave to be married. Ivan Ilyich remembered that he had somehow not had time to go into the matter, so that the matter of the marriage had been settled offhand, in haste. But yet he did remember exactly that Sildonimov was receiving a wooden house and 400 rubles in cash as dowry with his bride. The circumstance had surprised him at the time. He remembered that he had made a slight jest over the juxtaposition of the names Sildonimov and Mlekopitaev. He remembered all that clearly. He recalled it and grew more and more pensive. It is well known that whole trains of thought sometimes pass through our brains instantaneously, as though they were sensations without being translated into human speech, still less into literary language. But we will try to translate these sensations of our heroes, and present to the listener at least the kernel of them, so to say, what was most essential and nearest to reality in them. For many of our sensations, when translated into ordinary language, seem absolutely unreal. That is why they never find expression, though everyone has them. Of course, Ivan Ilyich's sensations and thoughts were a little incoherent, but you know the reason. Why? Flashed through his mind.
Here we all talk and talk, but when it comes to action, it all ends in nothing. Here, for instance, take this Pseldonimov. He has just come from his wedding, full of hope and excitement, looking forward to his wedding feast. This is one of the most blissful days of his life. Now he is busy with his guests, is giving a banquet, a modest one, poor, but gay and full of genuine gladness. What if he knew that at this very moment I, his superior, his chief, am standing by his house listening to the music? Yes, really. How would he feel? No. What would he feel if I suddenly walked in, Of course, at first he would be frightened. He would be dumb with embarrassment. I should be in his way, and perhaps should upset everything. Yes, that would be so if any other general went in, but not I. That's a fact. Anyone else, but not I. Yes, Stepan Nikiforovich, you did not understand me just now, but here is an example ready for you. Yes, we all make an outcry about acting humanely, but we are not capable of heroism, of fine actions. What sort of heroism? This sort. Consider, in the existing relations of the various members of society, for me, after midnight, to go into the wedding of my subordinate, a registration clerk at 10 rubles the month, why, it would mean embarrassment, a revolution, the last days of Pompeii, a nonsensical folly. No one would understand it. Stepan Nikiforovich would die before he understood it. Why, he said, we should break down. Yes, but that's you old people, inert, paralytic people. But I shan't break down. I will transform the last day of Pompeii to a day of the utmost sweetness for my subordinate, and a wild action to an action normal, patriarchal, lofty and moral. How? Like this. Kindly listen. Here. I go in, I suppose. They are amazed, leave off dancing, look wildly at me, draw back, quite so. But at once I speak out. I go straight up to the frightened Pseldonimov, and, with a most cordial, affable smile, in the simplest words I say, "This is how it is. I have been at His Excellency Stepan Nikiforovich's. I expect you know, close here in the neighbourhood. Well then, lightly, in a laughing way, I shall tell him of my adventure with Trifon. From Trifon I shall pass on to saying how I walked here on foot. Well, I heard music. I inquired of a policeman, and learned, brother, that it was your wedding. Let me go in, I thought, to my subordinates. Let me see how my clerks enjoy themselves and celebrate their wedding. I suppose you won't turn me out." Turn me out? What a word for a subordinate. How the devil could he dream of turning me out? I fancy that he would be half crazy, that he would rush headlong to seat me in an armchair, would be trembling with delight, would hardly know what he was doing for the first minute. Why, what can be simpler, more elegant than such an action? Why did I go in? That's another question. That is, so to say, the moral aspect of the question. That's the pith. What was I thinking about? Yes. Well, of course, they will make me sit down with the most important guest, some titular counsellor or a relation who's a retired captain with a red nose. Gogol describes these eccentrics so capitally. Well, I shall make acquaintance, of course, with the bride. I shall compliment her. I shall encourage the guests. I shall beg them not to stand on ceremony, to enjoy themselves, to go on dancing. I shall make jokes. I shall laugh. In fact, I shall be affable and charming. I am always affable and charming when I am pleased with myself. The point is that I believe I am still a little, well, not drunk exactly, but, of course, as a gentleman, I shall be quite on an equality with them, and shall not expect any especial marks of, but morally, it is a different matter. They will,
understand and appreciate it. My actions will evoke their nobler feelings. Well, I shall stay for half an hour, even for an hour. I shall leave, of course, before supper, but they will be bustling about, baking and roasting. They will be making low bows, but I will only drink a glass, congratulate them, and refuse supper. I shall say, business, and as soon as I pronounce the word business, all of them will at once have sternly respectful faces. By that, I shall delicately remind them that there is a difference between them and me, the earth and the sky. It is not that I want to impress that on them, but it must be done. It's even essential in a moral sense when all is said and done. I shall smile at once, however, I shall even laugh. And then they will all pluck up courage again. I shall jest a little again with the bride. I may even hint that I shall come again in just 9 months to stand godfather. And she will be sure to be brought to bed by then. They multiply, you know, like rabbits, and they will all roar with laughter, and the bride will blush. I shall kiss her feelingly on the forehead, even give her my blessing. And next day my exploit will be known at the office. Next day I shall be stern again. Next day I shall be exacting again, even implacable. But they will all know what I am like. They will know my heart. They will know my essential nature. He is stern as a chief, but as a man he is an angel. And I shall have conquered them. I shall have captured them by one little act which would never have entered your head. They would be mine. I should be their father. They would be my children. Come now, Your Excellency, Stepan Nikiforovitch, go and do likewise. What do you know? Do you understand that Pseldonimov will tell his children how the general himself feasted and even drank at his wedding? Why, you know, those children would tell their children, and those would tell their grandchildren, as a most sacred story, that a grand gentleman, a statesman, and I shall be all that by then, did them the honour, and so on, and so on. Why, I am morally elevating the humiliated. I restore him to himself. Why, he gets a salary of 10 rubles a month. If I repeat this 5 or 10 times or something of the sort, I shall gain popularity all over the place. My name will be printed on the hearts of all, and the devil only knows what will come of that popularity. These, or something like these, were Ivan Ilyich's reflections. A man says all these sorts of things to himself, gentlemen, especially when he is in rather an eccentric condition. All these meditations passed through his mind in something like half a minute, and of course he might have confined himself to these dreams, and after mentally putting Stepan Nikiforovitch to shame, have gone very peacefully home and to bed. And he would have done well. But the trouble of it was that the moment was an eccentric one. As ill luck would have it, at that very instant, the self-satisfied faces of Stepan Nikiforovitch and Semyon Ivanovitch suddenly rose before his heated imagination. "We shall break down," repeated Stepan Nikiforovitch, smiling disdainfully. "He-he-he!" Semyon Ivanovitch seconded him with his nastiest smile. "Well, we'll see whether we do break down," Ivan Ilyich said resolutely, with a rush of heat to his face. He stepped down from the pavement, and, with resolute steps, went straight across the street towards the house of his registration clerk, Pseldonimov. His star carried him away. He walked confidently in at the open gate, and contemptuously thrust aside with his foot the shaggy, husky little sheepdog, who flew at his legs with a hoarse bark, more as a matter of form than with any real intention. Along a wooden plank he went to the covered porch, which led like a sentry to the box, and by 3 decaying wooden steps he went up to the tiny entry. Here, though a tallow candle or something in the way of a night light was burning somewhere in a corner,
it did not prevent Ivan Ilyich from putting his left foot, just as it was in its galosh, into a galantine which had been stood out there to cool. Ivan Ilyich bent down, and, looking with curiosity, he saw that there were two other dishes of some sort of jelly, and also two shapes, apparently, of blancmange. The squashed galantine embarrassed him, and for one brief instant the thought flashed through his mind whether he should not slink away at once. But he considered this too low, reflecting that no one would have seen him, and that they would never think he had done it. He hurriedly wiped his galosh to conceal all traces, fumbled for the felt-covered door, opened it, and found himself in a very little anteroom. Half of it was literally piled up with greatcoats, wadded jackets, cloaks, capes, scarves, and galoshes. In the other half, the musicians had been installed. Two violins, a flute, and a double bass. A band of four picked up, of course, in the street. They were sitting at an unpainted wooden table, lighted by a single tallow candle, and, with the utmost vigour, were sawing out the last figure of the quadrille. From the open door into the drawing-room, one could see the dancers in the midst of dust, tobacco smoke, and fumes. There was a frenzy of gaiety. There were sounds of laughter, shouts and shrieks from the ladies. The gentlemen stamped like a squadron of horses. Above all the bedlam, there rang out words of command from the leader of the dance, probably an extremely free and easy and even unbuttoned gentleman. "Gentlemen, advance! Ladies, chain! Set to partners!" And so on and so on. Ivan Ilyich, in some excitement, cast off his coat and galoshes, and, with his cap in his hand, went into the room. He was no longer reflecting, however. For the first minute, nobody noticed him. All were absorbed in dancing the quadrille to the end. Ivan Ilyich stood as though entranced, and could make out nothing definite in the chaos. He caught glimpses of ladies' dresses, of gentlemen with cigarettes between their teeth. He caught a glimpse of a lady's pale blue scarf, which flicked him on the nose. After the wearer, a medical student, with his hair blown in all directions on his head, pranced by in wild delight and jostled violently against him on the way. He caught a glimpse, too, of an officer of some description who looked half a mile high. Someone in an unnaturally shrill voice shouted, "Oh, Seldonimov!" as the speaker flew by, stamping. It was sticky under Ivan Ilyich's feet. Evidently the floor had been waxed. In the room, which was a very small one, there were about 30 people. But a minute later the quadrille was over, and almost at once the very thing Ivan Ilyich had pictured when he was dreaming on the pavement took place. A stifled murmur, a strange whisper, passed over the whole company, including the dancers, who had not yet had time to take breath and wipe their perspiring faces. All eyes, all faces, began quickly turning towards the newly arrived guest. Then they all seemed to draw back a little and beat a retreat. Those who had not noticed him were pulled by their coats or dresses and informed. They looked around, and at once beat a retreat with the others. Ivan Ilyich was still standing at the door without moving a step forward, and between him and the company there stretched an ever-widening empty space of floor, strewn with countless sweetmeat wrappings, bits of paper and cigarette ends. All at once, a young man in uniform with a shock of flaxen hair and a hooked nose stepped timidly out into that empty space. He moved forward, hunched up, and looked at the unexpected visitor exactly with the expression with which a dog looks at its master when the latter has called him up and is going to kick him. "Good evening, Seldonimov. Do you know me?" said Ivan Ilyich, and felt at the same time that he had said this very awkwardly. He felt, too, that he was perhaps doing something horribly stupid at that moment.
Your Excellency, muttered Seldonimov.
"To be sure. I have called in to see you quite by chance, my friend, as you can probably imagine. But evidently Pseldonimov could imagine nothing. He stood with staring eyes in the utmost perplexity.
You won't turn me out, I suppose. Pleased or not, you must make a visitor welcome, Ivan Ilyich went on, feeling that he was confused to a point of unseemly feebleness, that he was trying to smile and was utterly unable, that the humorous reference to Stepan Nikiforovitch and Trifon was becoming more and more impossible. But as ill luck would have it, Pseldonimov did not recover from his stupefaction, and still gazed at him with a perfectly idiotic air. Ivan Ilyich winced. He felt that in another minute something incredibly foolish would happen.
"I am not in the way, am I? I'll go away," he faintly articulated, and there was a tremor at the right corner of his mouth. But Pseldonimov had recovered himself.
"Good heavens, Your Excellency! The honour!" he muttered, bowing hurriedly. "Graciously, sit down, Your Excellency!"
And recovering himself still further, he motioned him with both hands to a sofa before which a table had been moved away to make room for the dancing. Ivan Ilyich felt relieved and sank on the sofa. At once someone flew to move the table up to him. He took a cursory look around and saw that he was the only person sitting down. All the others were standing, even the ladies. A bad sign. But it was not yet time to reassure and encourage them. The company still held back, while before him, bending double, stood Pseldonimov, utterly alone, still completely at a loss and very far from smiling. It was horrid. In short, our hero endured such misery at that moment that his Harun al-Rashid-like descent upon his subordinates for the sake of principle might well have been reckoned an heroic action. But suddenly a little figure made its appearance beside Pseldonimov and began bowing. To his inexpressible pleasure and even happiness, Ivan Ilyich at once recognized him as the head clerk of his office, Akim Petrovich Zubikov. And though, of course, he was not acquainted with him, he knew him to be a businesslike and exemplary clerk. He got up at once and held out his hand to Akim Petrovich, his whole hand, not two fingers. The latter took it in both of his with the deepest respect. The general was triumphant. The situation was saved. And now, indeed, Pseldonimov was no longer, so to say, the second person, but the third. It was possible to address his remarks to the head clerk in his necessity, taking him for an acquaintance, and even an intimate one, and Pseldonimov, meanwhile, could only be silent and be in a tremor of reverence, so that the proprieties were observed. And some explanation was essential. Ivan Ilyich felt that. He saw that all the guests were expecting something, that the whole household was gathered together in the doorway, almost creeping, climbing over one another in their anxiety to see and hear him. What was horrid was that the head clerk, in his foolishness, remained standing.
"Why are you standing?" said Ivan Ilyich, awkwardly motioning him to a seat on the sofa beside him.
"Oh, don't trouble, I'll sit here."
And Akim Petrovich hurriedly sat down on a chair, almost as it was being put for him by Pseldonimov, who remained obstinately standing.
"Can you imagine what happened?" addressing himself exclusively to Akim Petrovich in a rather quavering, though free and easy voice.
He even drawled out his words, with special emphasis on some syllables, pronounced the vowel ah like eh. In short, felt and was conscious that he was being affected, but could not control himself. Some external force was at work. He was painfully conscious of many things at that moment.
"Can you imagine? I have only just come from Stepan Nikiforovich Nikiforov's. You have heard of him, perhaps, the Privy Councillor? You know, on that special committee."
Akim Petrovich bent his whole person forward respectfully, as much as to say, "Of course we have heard of him."
"He is your neighbour now,
Ivan Ilyich went on, for one instant, for the sake of ease and good manners, addressing Pseldonimov, but he quickly turned away again, on seeing from the latter's eyes that it made absolutely no difference to him.
"The old fellow, as you know, has been dreaming all his life of buying himself a house. Well, and he has bought it, and a very pretty house, too. Yes. And today was his birthday, and he had never celebrated it before. He used even to keep it secret from us. He was too stingy to keep it. But now he is so delighted over his new house that he invited Semyon Ivanovich Shipolyenko and me, you know?"
Akim Petrovich bent forward again. He bent forward zealously. Ivan Ilyich felt somewhat comforted. It had struck him, indeed, that the head clerk possibly was guessing that he was an indispensable point d'appui for His Excellency at that moment. That would have been more horrid than anything. "So we sat together, the three of us. He gave us champagne. We talked about problems, even disputed."
Akim Petrovich raised his eyebrows respectfully.
"Only that is not the point. When I take leave of him at last, he is a punctual old fellow, goes to bed early, you know, in his old age. I go out. My Trifon is nowhere to be seen. I am anxious. I make inquiries. What has Trifon done with the carriage? It comes out that, hoping I should stay on, he had gone off to the wedding of some friend of his, or sister, maybe, goodness knows, somewhere here on the Petersburg side, and took the carriage with him while he was about it." Again, for the sake of good manners, the general glanced in the direction of Pseldonimov. The latter promptly gave a wriggle, but not at all the sort of wriggle the general would have liked.
"He has no sympathy, no heart," flashed through his brain.
"You don't say so," said Akim Petrovich, greatly impressed. A faint murmur of surprise ran through all the crowd. "Can you fancy my position?" Ivan Ilyich glanced at them all. "There was nothing for it. I set off on foot. I thought I would trudge to the Great Prospect and there find some cabby." "He he
he," Akim Petrovich echoed.
Again, a murmur, but this time on a more cheerful note, passed through the crowd. At that moment, the chimney of a lamp on the wall broke with a crash. Someone rushed zealously to see to it. Pseldonimov started and looked sternly at the lamp, but the general took no notice of it, and all was serene again. "I walked, and the night was so lovely, so still. All at once I heard a band, stamping, dancing. I inquired of a policeman. 'It is Pseldonimov's wedding.' 'Why, you were giving a ball to all Petersburg side, my friend. Ha ha!'"
He turned to Pseldonimov again.
"To be sure," Akim Petrovich responded. There was a stir among the guests again, but what was most foolish was that Pseldonimov, though he bowed, did not even now smile, but seemed as though he were made of wood. "Is he a fool or what?" thought Ivan Ilyich. "He ought to have smiled at that point, the ass, and everything would have run easily." There was a fury of impatience in his heart. "I thought I would go in to see my clerk. He won't turn me out, I expect. Pleased or not, one must welcome a guest. If you must please excuse me, my dear fellow. If I am in the way, I will go. I only came in to have a look." But little by little, a general stir was beginning. Akim Petrovich looked at him with a mawkishly sweet expression, as though to say, "How could Your Excellency be in the way?" All the guests stirred and began to display the first symptoms of being at their ease. Almost all the ladies sat down, a good sign and a reassuring one. The boldest spirits among them fanned themselves with their handkerchiefs. One of them, in a shabby velvet dress, said something with intentional loudness. The officer addressed by her would have liked to answer her as loudly, but seeing that they were the only ones speaking aloud, he subsided.
The men, for the most part government clerks, with two or three students among them, looked at one another as though egging each other on to unbend, cleared their throats, and began to move a few steps in different directions. No one, however, was particularly timid, but they were all restive, and almost all of them looked with a hostile expression at the personage who had burst in upon them to destroy their gaiety. The officer, ashamed of his cowardice, began to edge up to the table.
"But I say, my friend, allow me to ask your name," Ivan Ilyich asked Pseldonimov.
"Porfiry Petrovich, Your Excellency," answered the latter, with staring eyes as though on parade.
"Introduce me, Porfiry Petrovich, to your bride. Take me to her.
And he showed signs of a desire to get up. But Pseldonimov ran full speed to the drawing-room. The bride, however, was standing close by at the door, but as soon as she heard herself mentioned, she hid. A minute later, Pseldonimov held her up by the hand. The guests all moved aside to make way for them. Ivan Ilyich got up solemnly and addressed himself to her with a most affable smile.
"Very, very much pleased to make your acquaintance," he pronounced, with a most aristocratic half-bow. "Especially on such a day."
He gave a meaning smile. There was an agreeable flutter among the ladies.
"Charmé,"
the lady in the velvet dress pronounced almost aloud. The bride was a match for Pseldonimov. She was a thin little lady, not more than 17, pale, with a very small face and a sharp little nose. Her quick, active little eyes were not at all embarrassed. On the contrary, they looked at him steadily and even with a shade of resentment. Evidently Pseldonimov was marrying her for her beauty. She was dressed in a white muslin dress over a pink slip. Her neck was thin, and she had a figure like a chicken's, with the bones all sticking out. She was not equal to making any response to the general's affability.
"But she is very pretty,"
he went on in an undertone, as though addressing Pseldonimov only, though intentionally speaking so that the bride could hear. But on this occasion, too, Pseldonimov again answered absolutely nothing, and did not even wriggle. Ivan Ilyich fancied that there was something cold suppressed in his eyes, as though he had something peculiarly malignant in his mind. And yet he had at all costs to wring some sensibility out of him. Why, that was the object of his coming.
"They are a couple, though," he thought.
And he turned again to the bride, who had seated herself beside him on the sofa, but in answer to his two or three questions he got nothing but yes or no, and hardly that.
"If only she had been overcome with confusion," he thought to himself, "then I should have begun to banter her. But as it is, my position is impossible."
And as ill luck would have it, Akim Petrovich, too, was mute, though this was only due to his foolishness. It was still unpardonable.
"My friends, haven't I perhaps interfered with your enjoyment?" he said, addressing the whole company.
He felt that the very palms of his hands were perspiring.
"No, don't trouble, Your Excellency. We are beginning directly, but now we are getting cool," answered the officer.
The bride looked at him with pleasure. The officer was not old and wore the uniform of some branch of the service. Pseldonimov was still standing in the same place, bending forward, and it seemed as though his hooked nose stood out further than ever. He looked and listened like a footman, standing with the greatcoat on his arm, waiting for the end of his master's farewell conversation. Ivan Ilyich made this comparison himself. He was losing his head. He felt that he was in an awkward position, that the ground was giving way under his feet, that he had got in somewhere and could not find his way out, as though he were in the dark. Suddenly, the guests all moved aside, and a short, thick-set, middle-aged woman made her appearance. Dressed plainly, though she was in her best, with a big shawl on her shoulders, pinned at her throat, and on her head, a cap to which she was evidently unaccustomed. In her hands she carried a small round tray
on which stood a full but uncorked bottle of champagne and two glasses, neither more nor less. Evidently the bottle was intended for only two guests. The middle-aged lady approached the general.
"Don't look down on us, Your Excellency," she said, bowing. "Since you have deigned to do my son the honour of coming to his wedding, we beg you graciously to drink to the health of the young people. Do not disdain us. Do us the honour."
Ivan Ilyich clutched at her as though she were his salvation. She was by no means an old woman, 45 or 46, not more, but she had such a good-natured, rosy-cheeked, such a round and candid Russian face. She smiled so good-humouredly, bowed so simply, that Ivan Ilyich was almost comforted and began to hope again.
"So you are the mother of your son," he said, getting up from the sofa.
"Yes, my mother, Your Excellency," mumbled Pseldonimov, craning his long neck and thrusting forward his long nose again.
"Ah, I am delighted, delighted to make your acquaintance. Do not refuse us, Your Excellency. With the greatest pleasure."
The tray was put down. Pseldonimov dashed forward to pour out the wine. Ivan Ilyich, still standing, took the glass.
"I am particularly, particularly glad on this occasion that I can," he began, "that I can testify before all of you. In short, as your chief, I wish you, madam," he turned to the bride, "and you, friend Porfiry, I wish you the fullest, completest happiness for many long years."
And he positively drained the glass with feeling, the seventh he had drunk that evening. Pseldonimov looked at him gravely and even sullenly. The general was beginning to feel an agonizing hatred of him. "And that scarecrow," he looked at the officer, "keeps obtruding himself. He might at least have shouted hurrah, and it would have gone off. It would have gone off. And you too, Akim Petrovich, drink a glass to their health," added the mother, addressing the head clerk. "You are his superior. He is under you. Look after my boy, I beg you, as a mother. And don't forget us in the future, our good, kind friend, Akim Petrovich." "How nice these old Russian women are," thought Ivan Ilyich. "She has livened us all up. I have always loved the democracy." At that moment, another tray was brought to the table. It was brought in by a maid wearing a crackling cotton dress that had never been washed, and a crinoline. She could hardly grasp the tray in both hands, it was so big. On it there were numbers of plates of apples, sweets, fruit meringues and fruit cheeses, walnuts, and so on and so on. The tray had been till then in the drawing-room for the delectation of all the guests, and especially the ladies, but now it was brought to the general alone. "Do not disdain our humble fare, Your Excellency. What we have, we are pleased to offer," the old lady repeated, bowing. "Delighted," said Ivan Ilyich, and with real pleasure took a walnut and cracked it between his fingers. He had made up his mind to win popularity at all costs. Meantime, the bride suddenly giggled.